1 Kings chapter 17, verses 7 to the end of the chapter. Sometime later, the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food." So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, "Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink?" As she was going to get it, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as the Lord your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said, but first make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land." She went and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" "Give me your son," Elijah replied. He took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, "O Lord my God, have you brought tragedy also upon this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die?" Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this boy's life return to him." The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, "Look, your son is alive." Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth." Thanks be to God. I have a particular fondness for that particular passage. It just always makes me feel kind of warm and fuzzy inside. I love the fact that the woman is so cynical. I'm going to go and make some food, and then we're going to go home and die. It's like Uriah Heep and Eeyore rolled into one, isn't it, really? There you go. We're going to stand and sing again. Holy Spirit, living breath of God. 11b is the second part of the verse, which is begins with the large crowd. Chapter 12. 37b to the end of the chapter. The large crowd listened to him with delight. As he taught, Jesus said, "Watch out for the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and be greeted in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. Such men will be punished most severely." Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins, worth only a fraction of a penny. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, I tell you the truth, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on. May God bless to us that reading from his word. I'd like to start off with the first part, and then I'll move on to the second part, and then we'll finish. Oh, I'd just like to give you signposts all the way through. But the first part is, I want to talk about these teachers of the law. Essentially, it's the scribes and the Pharisees that Jesus is talking about. And these people think that they are doing all the right things in their religion. Or do they? You see, every commentary I've read tells me that this is what they were doing, and they thought that it was because that made them holy to do these things. And I actually think that's a little bit generous. I think the commentators need to say it as it is. These people were manipulative, and they knew exactly what they were doing. Because I don't believe that people don't know what they're doing. Look at what it is they're doing. As he taught, Jesus said, watch out for the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and be greeted in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. Such men will be punished most severely. How many of you pop on flowing robes just because that's perfectly ordinary? Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. And how many of you go into a lengthy prayer just because you're on your own? Or do you only do, or do we only do and experience lengthy prayers when there's someone there to listen? The number of times I hear sermons preached in prayers. And I wish to, and then I say to someone afterwards, have you ever thought about preaching? Oh no, that's not for me. Well, you just did 20 minutes in the prayer. When my dad was at college, he went to a particular, he was with a church, he went to the prayer meeting every week. And he began to wonder why he bothered. Because one woman would start the prayer meeting every single week. She would pray around the entire world for about 25 minutes. And all he wanted to say was what she said. Because there was nothing left for anyone else. We do not wish to be placed at the most. Listen to what it says. They like to walk around in flowing robes and to be greeted in the marketplaces. Look at me, everyone. Aren't I holy? I want people to notice me. I want people to go, oh, look in. Oh, it's Rabbi so and so. It's whoever. Oh, aren't they great? They have the most important seat in the synagogues. That doesn't come about just because you're just being ever so humble. That comes about because you're forcing people to recognize you for your holiness and your righteousness. And there is absolutely no way people do that without knowing what they're doing. Now, you can all tell me that I have a very cynical nature and a cynical view of human nature, but I'm sorry, I did a degree in drama. And I'll tell you why that's important. I was having a very long discussion with someone recently about this. The reason it's important is when you are learning to act, and you do actually learn to act, you don't just go for it. When you're learning to act and you're studying it properly, the one thing you do is you read the text. Okay, because the text is what tells you all about the character you need to act. And you read everything. So first of all, you write down, what do I say about myself? Or what does my character say about himself? And then what do other people say about my character? Okay? And if you've ever read a play as an actual play, there are very few indications as to who the person actually is that are explicit. It might say a really tiny direction in brackets and in italics, haughtily, to give you the idea that you've got to say that word haughtily, but you don't get much. You don't get a character analysis. You have to perform that. And you have to perform that, and you have to create truth on stage so that the audience can read that. Because I know none of you think you do it, but you are all reading people all the time. And you are analysing people all the time. So when I pick up a text, whatever text it is, and it's talking about people's actions, I am in their head going, why are they doing it? It helps me solve problems, actually. Why is that person behaving the way that they are? And so I look at all the evidence around it, and I go, oh, that's why. That's the root cause. Because we only ever deal, what we tend to look at is the presenting symptom. We never look at the disease. So why has that person just flown off the handle? Well, maybe I need to do a little bit of digging, and now I know their motivation. Now, if you've been in acting circles, it's, what's my motivation, darling? Okay, well, what's my motivation? Why am I behaving the way that I am? Now, I look at this. Why are they behaving the way they are? Because they want people to notice them. Because they're actually quite insecure. And they want people to say, oh, you're ever so good. Oh, aren't you brilliant? And they like sitting at the front. And they like wearing fancy robes. And this next verse, verse 40, bothers me immensely. This is why I sit there and go, they didn't do this by accident. They devour widows' houses. Bernard Shaw wrote a play called Widowers' Houses, by the way, which is really interesting. If you get the chance to go and watch it, it's worth watching, but it's about 2.5 hours long, and there's no jokes. But what does it mean to devour widows' houses? To take them. They are taking widows' houses, and they are saying to them, this is for the Lord. They're telling them, manipulation, exactly, Richard, they're telling them that if you do this, then that's okay. God will be happy with you. There's not a great deal of difference there than there was when we were looking at the Reformation. There's not a great deal of difference there with them selling an indulgence. If you give me enough money, your soul will be okay. So these widows, these vulnerable people in society, are losing their support and their house because they think it's going to make them all right with God. Jesus isn't messing around when he says such men will be punished most severely. You don't take someone's house by accident. And you definitely don't take someone's house not knowing what you're doing. And so I get really cross when I hear almost excuses being made for the behavior of these Pharisees. Because I think we're doing down what Jesus is trying to say. Jesus is angry in a righteous way, but he is angry. These people are doing a wrong thing. Fine, if you want to leave your house to someone after you're dead, that's up to you, but don't start taking it off them whilst they're still living in it. It's appalling behavior. And you need to be shocked. We have sanitized the Bible so much, we have read it so often, that we are losing the shock power of this. This is atrocious behavior. The women and the orphans and the widows. If you go through scripture, it's all about the widows and the orphans, the widows and the orphans. Why? Because they are the most vulnerable in society. If the widows aren't looked after, the eldest son is, or the son-in-law of the eldest daughter, has to make the choice as to whether he supports his mother or his mother-in-law. That's Jewish law. That was what it was at the time. Why is Jesus a carpenter? To support his mum, because Joseph is dead. You can't tell me Jesus didn't cut the grade to make it into rabbi school when at the age of 12 he is wowing the priests in the temple courts. So why is he a carpenter? Because he needed to support his mum. And it's only once he gets to a point where his mum, where maybe one of the younger kids has now taken on the business, that he can go on in order to do what he has been called to do in his ministry. The orphan, if you don't have a father, you are lost. Because that eldest son doesn't have to do anything for you either. Doesn't have to take you in. Now, 9 times out of 10 they would. But do you know what? These people are not living on very much. They're living on like a penny a day. And you're going to take on 2 extra mouths who aren't actually bringing anything in. But it won't be 2 extra mouths, will it? It'll probably be about 5 or 6. And they're not economically active. So, really sorry, this is a tough decision, but I can't look after you. So along comes this guy and he says, I'll tell you what, I'll take your house off you, give you a little bit of money, you'll be able to support yourself, but because I'm doing you a favour, I'll buy it at 10% of the price it's actually worth. That's what it means by devouring widows' houses, and we should be cross. Jesus is here as knew what he was talking about. And you can see the hackles be kind of going up of, oh, yeah, them, those horrible people. Add your own expletive as to how annoying these people are. And then it's no accident that the next verses talk about a widow's offering. So just listen to that again. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, probably so everybody heard it. And they didn't put paper in, no, they did it in coins so that you could hear it chinking. When we do this in Open the Book, we do one that you count the numbers and it's... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, then it's 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and then 100, 200, 300, just to make the point that these people are making a huge donation. Oh, look, everybody, just about to put my money in the offering. What does Jesus say? Don't let your right hand know what your left hand's doing. Because that's not the way this works. You've got to show true humility, which is, not going to make a big show of who I am and what I do. This is about my service between me and God. Then along comes this woman. A poor widow came and put in 2 very small copper coins worth only a fraction of a penny. They reckon it was worth about the equivalent of a farthing. Now you've got to be a particular age, you know what a farthing is, but it's worth about the equivalent of a farthing, which was, what, 1/4 of a penny. Not a lot. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, I tell you the truth, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on. Now, link that with the passage just before it. Is Jesus saying this is a good thing or a bad thing? Because it's completely neutral, what Jesus says. He says this woman's put in everything she's got. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Why has she put in everything she's got? And he doesn't answer the question. But I think we could infer back from what we've just read that this could be an issue. These people have given out of their wealth. They're secure. She's given everything. Now, it's a perfectly legitimate interpretation of this passage to say that that's what we need to do for God. We need to give him everything. And I agree with that. I'm not going to say that it's wrong. It's a perfectly legitimate interpretation. We give God everything that we have, and he blesses us and looks after us. But there is also a moral issue that Jesus is talking about. Why on earth has this woman been forced by the temple to pay money when she can't even feed herself? What, sorry? They should be looking after her, but they're too busy devouring her house. It was a requirement that when you went to the temple, you had to make your offering. David. Exactly. The sale of the house. So, it's a big question for us. What does it mean to give what we have? And what does it mean to rest in our own strength? You see, it seems to me that the people who are walking around going, look at me, aren't I fab? Look at my lovely flowing robes and don't I look fantastic? They're only doing it out of what they've got. They want the praise of man. They want people to listen to them. They want the top seat at the table. They want people to stare at them when they're in the synagogue. In the olden days, many of you will remember this, in the olden days, the preacher or the minister would preach from the pulpit and the deacons would sit at the front, staring at the congregation. Woe betide any of those deacons if anyone fell asleep. But that's what they used to do. Really? Is that what we really want? Are we setting these people literally on a pedestal? Do they want to be at the front? Or should actually be better off not doing that? But also, how many of us, I mean, this is, you know, we're going back in time now, but I've been in church all my life. And I remember when, frankly, looking at you lot, you were an awful lot tidier. You know, now, frankly, scruffy, that's what I'm saying. But you wouldn't dreamt of turning up to church without a tie on. And ladies, where are your hats? I am appalled at the lack of hats. Apart from Jill, who's keeping up your end, basically, with her jaunty angle. But were we going to church to be seen? And what did we call it? We called it putting on your Sunday, it's your Sunday best. Why? But partly there's a good, wholesome reason. Actually, we want to do our best for God. We want people to see us. And, you know, this is, we've got two suits. You know, and this is the one we have for Sundays. Because God is worth it. And that's fantastic. But it turned into not so much. It was about who looked the best. And people tutting at you because you weren't wearing the right stuff. I mean, Dave wouldn't be able to get in a church about 50 years ago. Not with a t-shirt like that, anyway. But the point is that actually now we've changed that. We've relaxed a bit more because we've developed in our understanding, maybe, that actually God sees what's on the inside, not what you're wearing. So we can't really criticize the Pharisees as much as, because we've been doing it ourselves. I still feel a bit uncomfortable. I don't wear a tie, but there you go. Absolutely. So you've got preachers who, frankly, you know, there are certain mega church preachers in, or pastors in America, who are standing in front of you in a $5,000 suit. What are you doing? it's a worrying trend that we have, because it's the wrong type of religion. We're here to worship God. We're here to praise God. We're not here to be seen. We should be able to come just as we are. I think that's why Billy Graham was so successful, because that song that he played was just as I am, without one plea, just coming as I am. God sees who we are. There's no point lying to God. That's what it means to live on your own resources. And if you're putting everything into that, when you run out of resources, you'll find life is very unfulfilling, because you can't meet the standards that you've set for yourself. And then you'll think God doesn't like you because you aren't doing what you used to do with him. And then you realize you've never actually heard the gospel, because Jesus dies for all of us as we are, in our worst state. Because he dies for us as sinners. He dies for us as enemies of him. Don't think when Jesus is nailed to the cross, is he wondering whether you're wearing a tie or not? He's seen us in our most depraved state. And he says, you're worth dying for. But then when we trust in God, when we live in trusting in God. Now you see, the woman puts in 2 coins. She doesn't put in 1. She puts in 2. Now, I'm not amazing at maths, but I do know that 1/2 is 1. I know. You're impressed, aren't you? There was a reason I worked in a bank. So 1/2 is 1. She could have just put in 1 and kept 1 for herself. But the message that Jesus is giving is, this woman is putting everything she's got to live on because she trusts that God will provide for her. If you go back to the 1 Kings passage, the widow at Zarephath. Out of what she had, as grumpy as she was prepared to make a small loaf or cake of bread, which I've never quite understood why it's translated that way, a small loaf of bread for Elijah, and then some for herself, and then to go home and die. She was prepared to do it. Out of what she had, the little that she had, she was prepared to share it. And when the boy died, and I always think it's worth remembering this is a child, because there's no way that Elijah would have picked up a grown man out of his widow, out of the widow's arms. This is a child that's died. He was her future hope. You know that oldest son thing? When he gets old enough, he could support his mother. It also suggests that she's quite young. And her husband's died. But she's prepared to share what God has given her in order that someone else might be blessed. It's a bit like the song in Oliver, "Consider Yourself at Home," where the Artful Dodger sings, "Who cares? Whatever we've got, we share." Now, Dickens was a very moral man and was probably making that very point when he's got Dodger and Fagin, etc. Is who's the criminal here, etc. But anyway, we'll go off on one if I go into that. But the point is, what have we got? Now, I don't know about you, but I haven't got very much. I depressed my children the other day because I said to them, of course, well, we don't have a house, so when I retire, we're going to rely on the Retired Baptist Ministers Housing Organisation. So please do give generously to the Retired Baptist Ministers Housing Organisation. But we're going to rely on that. And I said, and then I'm not going to give you an inheritance of much, because I've got no house to give you. You know, you can have what's in my bank account, and you can definitely have all my debts. but actually, there isn't any of that. This is just who we are. But I'm prepared for you to share whatever you've got. You can come to me if you like. Treat me as I am. See me as we are. And I'll give you, you know, my last crust of bread if you need it. Because we trust in God. I had to send an email this week talking about something, and I wasn't very. I'm not very good at talking about me. I'm great at talking about other things, but I'm not very good at talking about me. And I said, I won't give you the context, but I said I have an overwhelming sense from a life lived like this that God will provide for me, regardless. God will provide for me. He may not do it when I want him to, and he may not do it in the amounts that I want, but God will provide for what I need, not necessarily what I want. But God has always provided for us. You know, we've had just blessings. I've told you before about the West Indian contingent of the church in Nottingham turning up with enough food to feed us for 2 weeks, not knowing that Dad hadn't been paid and we couldn't actually eat. And they weren't going to be able to sort the problem out in the church for 2 weeks. And these people had just decided, because God is moving, actually we're going to go and bless the pastor and his family. They didn't realize how much they were blessing the pastor and his family. We've had all sorts of experiences where God has provided, and it's fantastic when he does. And God blesses when we trust in him. Now, you might not be a millionaire. If you are, then see me afterwards for a standing order form. But you might not be a millionaire. It doesn't matter what you've got. You can share. And it might not be money, and it might not be food, it might just be your time. But God blesses that. The joy that I have in the time that I give is watching people grow, watching people change, watching people learn, and going on that journey with them. Nothing to do with me, I just give them the time. It's all to do with watching God work. And that is enough to bless me. And that's the same for us as a church, when we watch people go from, take Trudy as an example, because she's not here and she can't throw anything at me. But if you take Trudy as an example, to go from the girl who used to sit at the back and cry and never speak to anybody to the associate minister of Rugby Baptist Church, that's been an absolute joy and a pleasure to watch. What a privilege. And that's because we put our trust in her and our trust in God and our time and our energy, and we were patient and we listened to the sermons and we gave constructive, positive feedback, and we were always trying to build her up. And if we needed to have firmer conversations, then we'd have them with Grace. I don't know quite why Grace got it all, I don't know, but we would have those conversations with Grace. We are doing the widow's offering when we as a church say we're going to give you everything we've got and just kind of go, you do with it what you want to do with it. And whether you're loaded, whether you're not, whether you've got a house, whether you haven't, whether you've got food, whether you haven't, it doesn't really matter. You've got you. And the call at the end of this passage is essentially put yourself into that offering at the temple. You are all that you've got to live on. And allow God to use you for his purposes and be amazed at what he does.